State universities are in a tough position. They have to satisfy students and faculty and parents, and perhaps most significantly, the people who fund them. That is, the people in their state legislatures. And those legislators are sometimes difficult to please. Recently, the legislatures of Iowa and North Carolina introduced bills that have created quite a stir. The bills would require ideological balance, perhaps between Republicans and Democrats, on their university campuses. This is of great concern to the faculties of those campuses, and here today to discuss it with me is the director of the Center for Public Policy, the La Follette Center for Public Policy, at the University of Wisconsin. His name is Don Moynihan, and he's got lots of ideas on the subject. It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week it's about academic freedom and free speech.
Stay tuned for your Weekly Constitutional, a weekly discussion of interesting constitutional issues from gay rights to gun rights. YWC is produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier, and is hosted by Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law. And it's starting now.
Donald Moynihan is the director of the La Follette School of Public Affairs at the University of Madison at Wisconsin, and recently he penned a piece for the New York Times that caught my eye because it deals with a subject, two subjects really, that are near and dear to my heart, academic freedom and free speech on campus. We've dealt with the subject before. Perhaps you heard our episode where we talked about Melissa Click, the assistant professor of journalism at the University of Missouri, who was criticized and ultimately fired for having confronted a student journalist and preventing that journalist from covering a campus demonstration. Many people cited Ms. Click as an example of the left, the political left, being intolerant of free speech on campus. But Donald Moynihan thinks that perhaps the greater threat at most of our public universities comes from a different direction. It comes from the people who provide the money for our great public universities, that is, the state legislatures. And indeed, state legislatures in both Iowa and North Carolina have recently introduced bills that would require political balance or ideological balance for new faculty hires, whatever that means. Well, it certainly got Donald Moynihan's attention, and it certainly has mine. I think you'll enjoy the fascinating discussion that we're about to have.
Hi, my name is Don Moynihan. I'm a professor of public affairs at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I teach at our public policy school here. And I've been here for 11 years. Before that, I spent 2 years at the Bush School of Public Service and Leadership at Texas A&M University, and 1 year teaching in the Political Science Department at Michigan State University.
All fine places, but going back even further, do I detect a little bit of the Blarney Stone in your accent?
Yeah, I'm originally from Ireland, so I...
Well, what part?
County Kerry, so in the rural southwest of the country. It's a beautiful part of the country if you're ever over there. Great place to visit. I've spent my first 21 years in Ireland, and I've spent the last 20 years in the United States.
My. Well, it is a lovely country. We actually did an episode there on the Irish Constitution because I happened to be in Dublin when my son Benjamin was finishing up an internship there. And it was a marvelous experience and a marvelous country. So welcome, belatedly welcome to the United States. Glad to have you with us and glad to have you writing and speaking about a subject that's very, very dear to us here. And that subject is free speech with a related concept of academic freedom. And I saw your piece recently in the New York Times and I was intrigued by it. So I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, so this is not my area of speciality, and I'm interested in the idea of free speech primarily as a user of free speech on campus. And I guess the origins of my thinking about this arose from reading a series of pieces that I'd read in places like The New Yorker and The New York Times and The Washington Post that were about threats to free speech on campus. And they formed a pretty specific narrative, which was that on campus there's a real threat to free speech that's happening, we should be aware of and scared of, and it's really one that's led by students. So it's a student-led assault on free speech, that is driven mostly by identity politics. Mm-hmm. And so there's a couple of very well-known examples. So one was students in Oberlin complained about the cafeteria choices, that they weren't sufficiently culturally appropriate. There was another well-known example in Yale where one professor had pushed back a little bit against some guidance the administration had sent out there telling students, you know, maybe wearing culturally offensive costumes is not the right thing to do. And that professor, in turn, got into a lot of hot water by students, and there was some ugly scenes of students yelling at this professor and her spouse. And so I've read pieces where big thinkers like Nick Kristof and the New York Times page, or Mayor Bloomberg, or David Koch have essentially warned the world, oh, you need to hear about what's happening on campus. There's this real danger to free speech. And while I'm sympathetic to that set of concerns, it also didn't ring true with my experience.
Before we go on, Don, I'll just mention that we actually devoted an entire episode to that within the last 6 months or so, because we were very concerned about it, too. And that film that was on YouTube about the young Yale student screaming at her professors and using some pretty foul language and insisting that Yale was not a place for debate, but rather a safe place, or should be a safe place for students to go. That was striking. And we also discussed, I don't think we discussed specifically the Oberlin incident, but there was, of course, that infamous circumstance with Professor Melissa Click and her intervention. She felt on behalf of equality, but unfortunately she was chasing off newspaper reporters, student newspaper reporters. And so, yes, we've covered that part of it, but you're telling me that your experience is rather different from that. And so I'm intrigued.
I think it's important to not dismiss those concerns as being irrelevant or out of place. One thing I mentioned in my piece in the Times was, you know, I've never had a student come up to me and say, I'd really like a trigger warning in your syllabus. Or I've never had a student come and say, well, we need to set aside a safe space for this set of students or this particular set of concerns. And I've asked other professors about their experiences before I wrote the piece, saying, how frequently does this occur in your life? And by and large, most people did not report this happening. In fact, I couldn't find anyone among my network of social contacts on campus who told me, I feel like we're really being curtailed in what we can say. So on one dimension, my concern was maybe this is not quite as common as we think, that maybe those examples that you gave are not the tip of the iceberg, but they're really just one small set of examples that are unrepresentative of campus life generally.
You know, it's funny you should mention that, Don, because that's been my experience as well. I've taught at a number of law schools, and also I've taught undergraduates at several institutions. And the only time I can even recall anyone getting the least bit concerned about anything that I said or did involved a final exam where the hypothetical involved a local phenomenon in Appalachia, snake handling churches. And apparently one student was just terrified of snakes and had, I mean, you know that's a fairly specific sensitivity. And, you know, that wasn't really political at all. I've certainly have had discussions in my constitutional law classes, especially my First Amendment classes, you know, especially when we've talked about things like racial epithets, or we've talked about gender-based epithets or other objectionable speech. And so I guess I've had, because I happen to teach in those areas, I've had some discussions about them. But now that you mention it, I don't recall any incidents like the ones at Yale or Oberlin or Missouri. So I guess my experience is similar to yours in that regard.
Yeah, and part of the reason I've become more engaged in thinking about free speech is that I have perceived some other dangers to it on campus. And so I work in a state that has a legislature that, on the one hand, is a big fan of the idea of free speech, but I think on the other hand is sometimes acting in a way that doesn't live up to those ideals. So our university has a board of regents. They're politically appointed. One thing I would single them out for praise is they adopted one of the most robust free speech policies that you'll find anywhere in the country. And that's something I take a lot of reassurance from. At the same time, we've had really specific examples just in the last couple of months. In Wisconsin, we've seen specific examples where legislators have maybe done things or said things that wasn't completely consistent with the ideal of free speech that's written into our university policy.
That's really funny you should say that, because especially the way you said it, because I've found through the years that everyone's in favor of free speech, and what they mean by that is their own free speech. It's only when somebody else starts saying things that the first person doesn't like that the first person then starts to propose limiting the other person's free speech.
Yeah, the theme of free speech for me, but not for thee, is a pretty consistent one. We're all for free speech in the abstract, as long as it protects my views, but we're often not willing to be offended or deal with speech that we disagree with. And, you know, the rights that we get from having strong free speech protections come with some responsibilities that every so often you are going to encounter speech that you disagree with, and you'll just have to deal with that rather than try to censor that speech. Right. So I could give a very specific example of that contradiction where we had a state senator who on the one hand has urged our university leaders to not give in to the political correctness crowd demanding safe spaces, safe words, universal apologies for hurt feelings. But at the same time, he also has contacted the university telling them he did not feel positively about, in this case, a doctoral student who was teaching a class where there was a reading assignment that dealt with homosexuality. And then he built on that by asking whether, you know, when we reform the UW system in the next budget, are we going to pay attention to this? There was another, I think it got some national attention, incident where it was an assistant professor who was teaching a course in an ethnic studies program called The Problem of Whiteness, that I think the legislator was responding to some calls he got from his constituents saying, this sounds really bad. And, you know, he called out that professor, suggested that maybe he shouldn't be employed. If the university stands with the professor, how can they expect taxpayers to support them? And he also suggested he would have his staff screen courses at the university to figure out if there's legitimate education going on.
And that's very troubling, of course, because these are the very people who hold the purse strings, or at least the purse strings for a significant amount of your budget.
Right. And there's a line there somewhere where our elected officials are perfectly entitled to weigh in and say, you know, we don't necessarily think this is a good course. Our constituents have concerns with this. I think you start to go past that line and into the area of censorship when you start associating teaching a specific class with a budgetary amount that the legislature will give you, or with whether someone should hold a job in the university. And so I think that was where the line was crossed in these particular examples. And again, the irony here is that I think in the abstract, our legislators would say, we care very much for free speech, but they're not necessarily willing to deal with speech that they disagree with or causes them offense, or they believe, from their perspective, might be some sort of left-wing indoctrination of our students.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week my guest is Donald Moynihan, who's the director of the La Follette School of Public Affairs at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. Don's very concerned about academic freedom and about free speech on campus, two subjects that are of great concern to me as well. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and speak some more with Don Moynihan. Stick around. And now it's time for our constitutional quiz, which this week was taped before a live audience at the Virginia State Finals of the We the People competition. The quiz guy couldn't be there, so I'm assisted by Meg Hubeck of the Center for Politics at the University of Virginia, and also by Cash Earhart of the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership.
Meg, Stuart, we are joined by Grant.
Hi, Grant.
Hi.
Where do you go to school?
I go to Glen Allen, and I'm representing Team Reagan.
All right, Team Reagan.
Team Reagan from yes. Glen Allen. Who's that named after?
Nancy Reagan.
Oh, Nancy Reagan, okay.
He just assumed it was named after a man.
Okay. So what's our question for Grant?
Which of the following is not considered a Reconstruction Amendment?
Not considered.
Look, he's okay. All excited. A, the 11th. B, the 13th. C, the 15th, or D, the 14th? A, the 11th, B, the 13th, C, the 15th, or D, the 14th?
It is A.
It is A. Ding, 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 ding,
yes,
ding.
Yes, we are. Grant, make sure you send us a message on our Facebook page. Give us your T-shirt size. We'll send you a T-shirt and a pocket constitution from James Madison's Montpelier. Now, before we go on, and I realize most of you probably already know this, but the amendment process for the Constitution is relatively rare. How many, I'm just looking around the room now, how many amendments do we have right now? Very good. You know, I could have asked that question in almost any other audience in the world. They would have had no idea of the answer, so good for you. 10 of them came out of the original process for the Bill of Rights and were ratified in 1791. It was really a continuation of the Constitutional Convention. And then we had the 11th, which had to do with sovereign immunity. Very, very good. And the 12th that had to do with reforming the presidential electoral process. Okay. And then we had a period of decades in the early 19th century when there were no amendments. And yet there was a huge burning issue there that was being debated off and on with increasing intensity during the 19th century, and that, of course, was slavery, which led to the secession crisis of 1860 and 1861, which led to the Civil War, which led to the defeat of the Confederacy. As we like to say, slavery was decided in the seminal case of Lee versus Grant. And then after that decision was handed down, then Congress got very busy with three amendments. The 13th did what?
Free the slaves.
13th was abolishing slavery. 14th was? Right, due process and equal protection. Yep. The first time equality is even mentioned in the Constitution. And then the 15th, of course, we've talked about a lot in my section today, and that did what? That's right, voting rights, or at least African-American men. All of those had to do with cleaning up the issue of slavery. And so we call them the Reconstruction Amendments. And then we went through another lengthy period before we amended the Constitution again. And that wasn't until the Progressive Era in the early 20th century. So these things don't come on a regular basis. And that's why it's important to always remember when a particular amendment was ratified and why. Grant, congratulations. Very well done. We appreciate you. You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Donald Moynihan this week. He's the director of the La Follette School of Public Affairs at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. And we're speaking about academic freedom, very important topic, and the related subject of free speech on campus. There's been a lot of criticism of political correctness on campus and all sorts of attempts to shut down free speech. But it turns out that those threats are coming from not just the political left, but perhaps also the political right. Indeed, maybe from some people in state legislatures.
So they were concerned about threats that they perceived as coming from the left wing, that is the political correctness crowd, but they themselves, perhaps coming from a more conservative perspective, are creating a threat to free thought and free speech on campus themselves.
Yeah, I think so. And I think they're doing this coming from a background where maybe they're not thinking about this from a free speech perspective, but most of our legislators come from a business background. They usually own their own business, and they look at this from the perspective of, do you have a problem employee? If that person is creating problems, you should just get rid of them. Ratterton from the perspective of what does it mean to maintain academic freedom? What good does that do to discourse on campus? And I think that bleeds over into other areas as well. So we have in the last couple of years seen debates in our legislature and in many others, Texas probably being the most visible example, where legislators have said, we want to put make it possible for people to have, bring guns into a classroom. And they're viewing this from a public safety perspective. Their argument is that if there is some sort of shooting on campus, wouldn't it be good if you had a good guy with a gun in the classroom? But from my perspective, that's a free speech problem, because I'm going to be a lot more circumspect in what I say in the classroom, and I'm going to be much less willing to engage students on contentious issues if I'm concerned that there is someone in the classroom who might have a combination of mental health problems as well as a gun in their backpack.
Yeah, or on their hip. I mean, depending on the state you're in, I mean, people can walk in, and I think there are probably few things in this world that tend to suppress speech more than one party packing heat as they're standing there. So that, yeah, that's another interesting issue that you bring up. And this is all sounding so familiar. We had an incident here in the state of Tennessee. Now, my institution's a private university. It's Lincoln Memorial University, and so we don't deal with the legislature. But right down the street, my friends and colleagues over at the University of Tennessee got in some hot water. Within the last year or so, apparently they had an Office of Diversity Initiatives, which sent out some guidance about pronouns to be used with transgendered people. And these were completely unfamiliar to most of us, so they're moving away from the he's and the she's and the they's and suggesting substitutes that, quite honestly, I have to admit, I'm not entirely sure how to pronounce myself. So this struck a lot of people as being somewhat unusual and coming out of left field, perhaps. But it struck some people in the Tennessee legislature very hard in that regard. And I don't know the exact status of it, but I think maybe what you've described is correct. I think maybe the funding for that office was withheld, which effectively means somebody gets terminated.
Right. And it's, you know, it's a shot across the bows about what sort of speech is appropriate or not. And I think there's some version of that story, maybe not as extreme in any public institution in a state where there's a clash about identity politics on campus, where students may push very strongly for one version of how people identify themselves or what sort of language they should use or how we talk about diversity with one another versus how that plays into campus, which, you know, if you come from a conservative background, you might think, well, this is just remedial parenting. Why are we brainwashing our kids with all of these left-wing ideas? And so part of the tension, I think, reflects a tension between what students are demanding on campus to reflect their identity politics, if you want to use that term, and what members of the legislature are thinking about when they're trying to represent their traditional values.
We've been talking about this, and we've talked about some specific examples, but let's go to the heart of the matter now. We've used the term academic freedom. Now, most people have heard of free speech, and most people at least have some idea of what that involves, but when you say academic freedom, what exactly are you talking about?
Well, so this idea actually sort of originates from Wisconsin when about just over a century ago, there was a labor economist who fell into disfavor with the legislature, and the legislature sought to have him removed, and the university pushed back very strongly, making the case that if it was going to engage in a deep discourse about ideas, if it was going to engage in what it called the search for truth, it needed to have some sort of protection. And so that's sort of the general principle. If you want to have the university operate as an institution that's not driven by the party politics of the day, if you want it to be driven by the goal of creating and disseminating knowledge, you need to provide it some level of protection from contemporary politics.
Yeah, I think you've hit it on the head, Don. And that's why I've always heard it said, is that there are basically two functions of a university or a college. And the first is, logically in order, is to create knowledge or to discover knowledge. If you're talking about the physical world, that's what those professors do when they go off and think their deep thoughts and read their books and write their articles and books and go to symposia. That's the generation of knowledge. And then the second thing is to disseminate that knowledge. That's what most people think of as the primary function of universities, because most people experience them, if they do experience them, as students. And, you know, the transmittal of the knowledge from the professors to the students. And I think academic freedom really touches upon both of those things, because if you truly are looking for knowledge, if you're searching for truth, then you've got to do it free of any constraints. You've got to do it without worrying that if you say something in a paper or if you say something in a classroom that somebody in a position of power finds objectionable, that you'll lose your job over it. Because we're all, you know, I don't know about you. I don't know if you're independently wealthy, but I'm not. And, you know, most of us need jobs.
Yeah, and most of us value our reputations, too.
Yeah.
And so one form of censorship is we cut your budget. So, it's not necessarily just the humanities, although that's the area that tends to get the most attention, or even social sciences. But if you work on climate change right now,
yes.
You know, I've had conversations with colleagues who said, I will not pick up the phone if the media calls, because I do not want my name in the newspaper. I do not want to become a target. And we're living in a state where, for example, the governor zeroed out funding for a renewable energy center that we had on campus. And so these are not completely unwarranted concerns. And there's also other forms of censorship, or at least criticism, that aren't government directed. So one thing I mentioned in my op-ed, you might find yourself, if you're a professor, on some social media site where you're being attacked. So some of us might have heard about Professor Watchlist, which tracks...
Oh, yes, I've heard about that. Could you explain what that is?
Well, it's a website that was set up. It's one of those social welfare nonprofits, or at least that's their tax status, so people can contribute to them anonymously. And the purpose of the website is to identify faculty who have allegedly left-leaning sympathies and to list their crimes online. It's by no means the only organization that does this. There's another one that's called Media Trackers, which it doesn't operate in every state, but it operates in Wisconsin, has identified individual faculty, targeted their work, called them partisan. In some cases, tried to find drunk driving records, for example, and profile that online. And so that's not government-led, but it does have this effect when you're thinking about, do I want to stick my neck out and make a comment that might make some people unhappy? And there is sort of a nexus between that and party politics. So, you know, for example, one person who wrote these sorts of profiles for Media Trackers in Wisconsin then moved to take a position with a state senator here as well. So it's not completely disconnected from politics. There is some connection between these groups.
Well, I'll play devil's advocate, even though I'm a great believer in both free speech and academic freedom. I'll just put myself in the position of being a legislator. Let's say I'm a senator or a representative in the Wisconsin legislature. Shouldn't I have something to say about what happens at the University of Wisconsin at Madison or some other part of the state? Shouldn't I have some? I mean, I'm charged with spending the public's money, and I want to make sure that we're spending the money for the purposes that it was intended. We have a great university. I want to make sure it's a great university. Shouldn't I have something to say about this? Shouldn't I be able to comment on these subjects?
Of course, legislatures are important because they carry the sovereign power of the people.
Yeah.
And they have to use that power wisely. I think it's helpful to sometimes think about universities in the way we would think about other bodies that we regulate in society. And so, for example, would you take the standard that just because a business takes public money, which obviously many of them do through grants or subsidies or tax breaks provided by the state, would you take the standard that it's appropriate to regulate the speech of the people who are hired into that business? Or to put it in other terms, you mentioned you're in a private university. Does it feel like a logical regulatory approach where you have essentially two organizations that are in the same business, that are competing for the same students, competing for the same faculty, competing for the same research grants, but you add a layer of regulatory burden on the public one, but not the private one? I think when you start to ask those sorts of questions, you realize there is a real temptation to end up micromanaging the university in a way that's not helpful. And that doesn't mean that universities shouldn't be held accountable, shouldn't be regulated. We have goodness knows how many reports we provide to the legislature each year. We have a governing body in our regents that are all political appointees. We have much demands from the marketplace via students as well as faculty that we're competing from. So we're accountable both to a political dimension, to a state government that gives us at this point 15% of our budget, as well as to a bunch of other stakeholders as well. And I think the wise legislator would take the approach of saying, well, in the long run, the best way for this organization to be successful is with a certain type of regulatory overview where we can allow the regions to specialize and avoid it becoming too political, because that'll ultimately damage the organization in the long run. And in the short run, that means that occasionally I'm going to see a class that I hate, or I'm going to hear about a speaker I disagree with, or some liberal professor will mouth off in the media on something that they don't know anything about. And we make those compromises all the time in democracies, where we're willing to sort of deal with some long-term benefits even if we have to encounter some short-term costs.
Freedom, academic freedom. It's a sham, I confess, for the way to success is set standards for trite and exceed them. Freedom, no, you can't just play free. You've got to play safe at the
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and we're speaking about free speech this week and academic freedom. We're speaking with Donald Moynihan, the director of the La Follette School of Public Affairs at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. After the break, we'll finish our discussion with Don Moynihan. Stick around. And now let's finish our discussion with Donald Moynihan, the director of the La Follette School of Public Affairs at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. You know, it's often been said that he who pays the piper calls the tune, and that's certainly true at public universities, but maybe it's not always such a good thing. I would encapsulate what you just said, at least from my perspective, as universities are special. Colleges are special. These are institutions that, as we've discussed, are devoted to the discovery and dissemination of knowledge. And given that special mission, we have to have a lot of leeway. We have to have a lot of freedom to explore ideas and follow the evidence wherever it leads us. Otherwise, we're not fulfilling our basic mission. So, to go back to my own hypothetical earlier, if I'm a state senator in Wisconsin, I think it'd be perfectly appropriate for me to make sure that nobody's embezzling money it'd be perfectly appropriate to make sure that if some professor is sexually harassing students, that there's a mechanism to discipline that person and take care of that situation. It's perfectly appropriate for me to make sure that the grounds are maintained properly. All the sorts of usual oversights one would have. It's just that when you get to the point where I, as a state senator, say, I don't like Professor this fellow Moynihan. He ran a seminar the other day, and I think he was saying some pretty incendiary things. Well, that's the point at which maybe I have to let Professor Moynihan say those things, even if I disagree with him.
I think you're exactly right. It gets to what is the purpose of a university or a college, and it's, again, creating and disseminating knowledge, or, you know, to put in the even more highfalutin terms, it's the search for truth. And
right.
We have relatively few institutions in society where that is their primary purpose. If you're in a private business, your goal is to generate value for yourself, for your stakeholders, through profit, and we absolutely need those institutions. But there aren't that many institutions out there whose goal is to just engender really thoughtful searches for knowledge. That's their primary purpose. So if you start messing with that, if you start seeing the university or college through the lens of politics first, then you're starting to sacrifice that primary mission of higher education.
Yep, I think that's right. I just saw something. In fact, my wife, who is on a Fulbright over in Lithuania, just sent me an email. She's trying to stay in touch with what's happening in higher education back here in the States. And apparently, the legislature of North Carolina has either recently passed or is considering a law or a regulation that would require some kind of ideological balance on faculties. And the proxy that they're going to use for that is party registration. So if you have a certain percentage of Democrats on your faculty, you need a certain matching percentage of Republicans, or if people have contributed to one party or the other. And some have even gone further and said that maybe the ideological makeup of the faculty should closely mirror that within the state. That seems to me to be very troubling as well.
So that bill has been proposed in North Carolina. A similar bill has been proposed in Iowa. And when you see two very similar bills being proposed in, you know, the space of a couple of days, that's usually a pretty good signal that there's some broader movement towards this. It's not just the idea of a single senator. And so, yeah, as you said, the idea would be that you would count the number of registered Democrats and registered Republicans, and if there's too much of an imbalance, you would not allow the university to hire someone from one party or another.
Well, let me ask you, on one level, that seems like a reasonable approach. What's wrong with that?
So, I think a variety of things are wrong with it. I'd start with, you know, if we were thinking about this with a private organization who's taking public money, which, again, you know, that's university in my state gives us 15% of our budget. They're not giving us 100% of our budget. Would you impose the same sort of intrusive regulation on those private organizations? And I think our knee-jerk reaction would be, no, of course, that's ridiculous. That is way too much government intervention in people's personal beliefs. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think that principle should be tossed out when it comes to public institutions. And I'm actually not sure whether these bills would pass constitutional muster, because there are some federal laws about not discriminating in job hiring processes based on political beliefs, and which cut both ways, right? If you truly believe that there are more liberals than conservatives in universities, you probably would want some legal protection for conservative job applicants so they wouldn't be discriminated against. Right. Mm-hmm. The other thing I think it does from the mission of the university is that it prioritizes political ideology and political loyalty over the other criteria by which we select people. So when we try to hire someone, we try to hire the best mind, the smartest person, the person who's pushing the field of research furthest along. Mm-hmm. If you say, well, it's important to hire a smart person, but first you have to make sure they're either a Democrat or a Republican, what you're telling me is that that set of political beliefs is more important than the search for knowledge. If I'm talking to that person in a seminar, then I have to bear in mind they're here because their political beliefs got them here and not because of their skills. And I think that's really troubling. Our job at a university is not to provide political representation. We're not a legislature. We're not a political party. We're engaged in search for knowledge. So once you start trying to jerry-rig the university, I think it becomes really a troubling place. The third problem with this whole approach is that it assumes people have these really rigid and fixed ideological beliefs, when I don't think that's true. I mean, I, you know, on some issues, I would probably be classified as a liberal. On some issues, I would, you know, for example, regulation or free speech, my beliefs fit more comfortably with the conservative side of the spectrum. I'm not registered with any party. And I find it discomforting that the idea that I would be pigeonholed as fitting into one belief system or another, and that my university couldn't hire someone depending on how I was pigeonholed. That you know, just seems incredibly Big Brother-ish.
Yeah, it's a sort of oversight that I don't think anybody in academia would be comfortable with. Do you think that we in academia do a good job of getting, you know, when we are left to our own devices, do we do a good job of getting a variety of viewpoints, especially within the humanities? Or are we allowing ourselves to skew too far one way or another on the political or ideological spectrum?
So I think there is actually a reasonable case to make that when it comes to public discussions of issues on campus, there should be room for different political viewpoints. I think there are good ways to do this and there are bad ways to do this. So if you want to bring in more conservative voices, having a research center on constitutional principles or on free enterprise or a speaker series that focuses on capitalism or the history of the United States. So areas where conservatives, I think, feel more comfortable and feel like their values are being represented, I think that's a constructive way to bring a diversity of ideological thought on campus. Trying to micromanage who's hired is the opposite of that. I think that's a really damaging way. And, you know, we're in the marketplace. Universities are, and I think this is one thing people don't necessarily understand, as students, we're sort of like professional footballs and professional baseball teams. If people who are really good at their job get hired away by other institutions. And so if you want to be the state that says, we're going to have this incredibly rigid system that doesn't respect academic freedom, then you're going to see your best and your brightest flee to the state. On the other hand, if you can come up with a way that says, we're going to find new ways of bringing a greater variety of voices on campus, I think by and large, most people would say that helps to reinforce academic freedom rather than challenge it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you said that this whole idea of academic freedom, to a great extent, was originated and championed in Wisconsin all those years ago. How are things faring there now in Wisconsin? Is the university standing up for academic freedom and free speech?
I think our university is, but I worry about our legislators. I mean, they've, in the last few years, also weakened tenure protections. Mm-hmm. And they framed that as a job entitlement, but certainly that's one mechanism by which people can feel comfortable in engaging in what might be seen as controversial speech or research. So I think people are sort of waiting for the other shoe to drop. They're waiting to see if there's going to be one of these bills that looks like North Carolina or Iowa. And frankly, what's happened in the last couple of years hasn't helped us on the academic marketplace. You know, we saw a reasonable number of people leave. We saw a lot of people get outside job offers because I think the perception was that Wisconsin was looking weak because of the actions of its legislature. And so we have to pay a lot of people much more money to stick around in the context where they felt like their rights and freedoms were being eroded.
Yeah, I think the analogy you used is an apt one, though I would simply interject that I don't think we make quite as money as professional football players, and most of us are not quite as good looking as them. But with those caveats, I see exactly what you're saying. It is a competition for talent, and if a state like North Carolina or Wisconsin adopt some of these policies, then that's going to make jobs at those places less desirable from an academic viewpoint. In fact, a friend of mine who's been on the show before, Jim Melcher, he's a professor at the University of Maine at Farmington. He's a proud, it's a beaver or is it a badger? It's a badger at Wisconsin, isn't it? That's right. He's a proud badger. And he is, I think he got his doctorate from your university all those years ago. And I recall him lamenting these moves, because he feels that it makes the institution look bad and that it's it heralds a downward course for the institution in the future. And I guess from what you're telling me, there have been repercussions.
Yeah, it hasn't helped in the last few years. It's certainly, you know, here in Minnesota, where they're putting more resources into higher education, whereas we've seen budget cuts along with some of these what feel like attacks from the legislature, and we've seen colleagues go to Minnesota. So it's, you know, we haven't seen many people come from Minnesota to here, and so that's our neighboring state, looks a lot like us, and it becomes more attractive when you go to a place has more resources, but also they will basically say, look, you're going to get to do your job. You're not going to be interrupted from that. And I think there's a broader point here about the history of universities in the United States, especially when you're talking about public ones. You look at land-grant universities, the great ones like Wisconsin. They're in the middle of the country. They're in the south of the country. I mentioned Texas A&M, where I used to teach. Mm-hmm. These were created as public institutions. They're not coastal elite institutions. They're serving the Midwest and the South. The sort of tragedy that I perceive is happening now, that I think our legislators are missing, is that every time they take a whack at these public institutions in the Midwest and the South, what they're doing is they're making it a little bit easier for the, especially private institutions, the MITs, the Harvards, the Stanfords, to lure away our best talent. Mm-hmm. We're facing more regulation, whereas private institutions are not dealing with these problems. And so when we're competing with them for the best people, for research funding, to get the best students to come in, we're increasingly being put at a disadvantage. And I do honestly feel that legislators are coming at this where they care about the university, and they don't quite realize that in the long run, they may be undoing what was one of the great educational achievements in the history of the United States.
I think you need to keep using that analogy, because I know there's a great rivalry between the Minnesota Vikings and the Green Bay Packers. And if you simply explain to your legislators that people are going to leave the Packers for the Vikings if the Packers don't have as good a stadium or as good equipment or don't pay as much money, and in much the same way, you're going to lose all your folks over to those terrible people at the University of Minnesota. Yeah, that's a very significant thing. So ultimately, what's the solution? Well, before we go on, but before I get to that ultimate question, it occurs to me that there can be similar abuses, similar attempts to micromanage academic freedom or to limit academic freedom at a private university. Now, I've got no beef at all with the board at Lincoln Memorial University. They've never said anything about anything I've said or done. And as far as I know, they don't interfere. But they could. And there are some private institutions. Is it your sense that, generally speaking, the boards of private institutions don't engage in this sort of behavior?
I think they have just fewer stakeholders that they have to please. And right. They're less stuck between a rock and a hard place. And so I think, you know, you can certainly see how private institutions might limit speech or limit the rights of individual faculty because they might think it hurts the institution, but they don't have to go cap in hand to the legislature every couple of years and say, you know, we're sorry about what happened on campus with this course, please give us new resources.
Right.
So I think they have a little bit of a freer hand to think about the good of the institution when they're thinking about issues of freedom of speech.
Okay, so now the ultimate question, then I'll let you go. What's to be done about this? What if you could craft a solution to this problem, what would it be?
So I think on the one hand, universities have to do better at illustrating and building upon the times we are actually being quite inclusive in fostering ideological diversity on campus. I think universities can do a better job of highlighting and bringing on speakers on campus that reflect alternative points of view that are still consistent with academic values of, you know, real evidence, honest argument. So I think that's part of the solution is being able to tell, especially Republican legislators, no, you have a place on campus. Your values are still valued on campus. So I think that's part of the solution. I think the other part of the solution is that somehow or another, we have to persuade legislators that these values of academic freedom are not ones that are going to be used to attack them, but are really ones that historically have provided great benefits for the state. You know, some of the institutions we've been talking about have been economic engines for their particular states, and they've done that by putting in place a set of values that include academic freedom. And so once you start messing with that, you might be making a long-term mistake that's going to be very hard to correct again in the future.
Well, Donald Moynihan of the University of Wisconsin at Madison, of the La Follette School of Public Policy, thanks so very much for these very, very important ideas and this very, very important subject.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
They've got the cash and we need 'em. Freedom, nothing really comes free. When you're earning your pay at the university. Freedom, academic freedom. It's a wonderful word, but in practice absurd. I write papers, but no one can read 'em. Freedom, if you want to be free, then make your escape from the university. Freedom, if you want to be free, then make your escape from the university.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Don Moynihan, who penned that really good article, that op-ed piece in the New York Times recently. It was called Who's Really Placing Limits on Free Speech? And it appeared in the January 9th issue. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by the Fifes and Drums of Colonial Williamsburg. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.